It doesn't really hurt because they don't have teeth, so they can't bite, but they sure can pinch. To tell you the truth, it actually kind of tickles. Being around all these ducks reminded me of one of my favorite stories from Greek mythology, that of Penelope, who in Homer's Odyssey was the wife of the hero Odysseus. When she was born, her father Icarius, a Spartan prince, threw her into the sea to drown because he wanted a son, but a family of ducks rescued her, and seeing this as an omen or a sign from the gods, Icarius named the child Penelope after the Greek word for duck, and raised her as his favorite child. When Penelope reached womanhood, the hero Odysseus asked for her hand in marriage. Although reluctant to part with his daughter, Icarius agreed, and Penelope went with her new husband to his home on the island of Ithaca. Penelope and Odysseus were deeply in love, so it was with great sorrow that Odysseus later left her to fight in the Trojan War. The Trojan War lasted 10 years. And it took Odysseus another 10 years to get home to Ithaca. During that time, Penelope received the attention of many suitors. For a while, she put them off by saying that she would consider marriage only after she finished weaving a shroud for her father-in-law, who was grieving over Odysseus's absence. Each day, Penelope would sit weaving the cloth, but at night, she would secretly unravel her work. After 3 years, a servant revealed Penelope's secret, and she had to finish the shroud. When her suitors became insistent again, Penelope announced that she would marry the man who could string a bow that Odysseus had left behind and shoot an arrow through the loops on a row of 12 axe heads. Unknown to Penelope, Odysseus had arrived home disguised as a beggar. He wanted to review the situation in his kingdom before revealing his return. The disguised Odysseus won the archery contest and then killed all the suitors. At first, Penelope would not believe that Odysseus was her husband, for the gods had hidden his identity from her. However, Odysseus revealed his true identity by telling Penelope a secret about their marriage that only she knew, that one leg of their bed was made from a still-living olive tree, and the loving couple were finally reunited. Of course, few academics took any of the stories regarding the Trojan War seriously, until Heinrich Schliemann actually discovered the fabled site of the lost city of Troy mentioned in the works of Homer. For much of Western history, claiming foreign ancestry was the key to political legitimacy. From the Roman Empire to the Renaissance, noble families across Europe insisted that they were not related to the populations they ruled. They traced their ancestry back to the illustrious foreign powers, including figures of myth and legend. Among the most popular were the protagonists of the Trojan War. Europeans were familiar with the exploits of the Greek heroes, such as Ajax and Achilles, as recorded in the Iliad. Roman emperors, Germanic warlords, and crusading nobles, however, identified themselves not with the Greek victors of the war, but with the defeated Trojans. While European nationalists today see migrants of the Middle Eastern wars as an existential threat to their homelands. European, Roman, and medieval elites boasted of their Trojan ancestors, refugees fleeing from the ruins of their Asian home. The most famous of these refugees was Aeneas, a legendary prince of Troy. Barely mentioned in the Iliad, he became a key figure of Roman myth in the 1st century BC. Romans imagined that the Trojan prince had escaped his city as it was sacked by the Greeks. Aeneas resettled in Italy, conquered the local people, and became the forefather of Romulus, the founder of Rome. The Roman Republic was by then master of the Mediterranean world, and the story of Aeneas offered justification for its conquest. By conquering the Italian peninsula, it could be argued Rome had finished Aeneas' mission. By humbling the Greek city-states and Hellenistic kingdoms of the Eastern Mediterranean and the Phoenicians, Rome had avenged Troy's fall. The Romans were an intensely patriotic people, but rather than imagine themselves as sons of the Italian soil, they preferred to think that they were of Aryan ancestry destined to reconquer and reign across the world. The legend of Aeneas was such a powerful ideological tool that Julius Caesar and his adopted son Augustus claimed that their genealogy proved direct descent from Aeneas. The poet Virgil immortalized their claims in the Aeneid, an epic poem about Aeneas' journey from Troy to Rome, and Caesar and Augustus transformed the Roman Republic into an empire ruled by a single dynasty, smoothing the transition by conflating Rome's Trojan heritage with their own family tree. This was effective for a while, until the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries, when groups of Germanic Aryans wrestled much of Western Europe from the Roman control. Besides seizing territory, Germanic elites also used the symbols of Roman authority, including claims of Trojan origins and symbols used in ancient Troy, such as the swastika, which the Aryan tribes also historically revered. For most ancient Greeks, the Trojan War was much more than just a myth. It was a defining moment in their distant past. According to Herodotus, the writer from the 5th century BC, considered the father of history, it was generally assumed to have been a real event. And while it is true that Herodotus sometimes exaggerates for effect, his accounts have consistently been found to be more or less reliable. The name Troy refers both to a place in legend and a real-life archaeological site. In legend, Troy is a city that was besieged for 10 years and eventually conquered by a Greek army led by King Agamemnon. The reason for the wars was, according to Homer's Iliad, the abduction of Helen, a queen from Sparta, by Paris, the son of Troy's king Priam. In some non-literal but deeper, hidden, or occult interpretations of the myth, Helen of Troy is linked to Lilith as the personification of death, but not in the physical context. In the mystery schools, death has a different spiritual meaning, as set forth in the Zohar, for example, concerning certain interpretations of the consequences brought about by the apple in the Garden of Eden story. Throughout the Iliad, the gods constantly intervene in support of characters on both sides of the conflict. Troy also refers to a real ancient city located on the northwest coast of Turkey, which, since antiquity, has been identified by many as being the Troy discussed in legend. Whether the Trojan War actually took place, and whether the site in northwest Turkey is the same Troy, is still a matter of debate. According to legend, the Trojan War took place near the end of the Bronze Age, probably before 1200 BC, possibly around the time that the Mycenaean civilization flourished in Greece. According to Heinrich Schliemann, who conducted a series of excavations in modern-day Turkey in the 1870s, the city of Troy goes back at least 2700 years, backed by treasures he discovered and claimed to be from King Priam. While there's no doubt that Schliemann did find golden artifacts, ancient swastikas, and real remnants from an ancient city in Anatolia, located where Troy was said to have once stood, it is still questionable if this was the same Troy spoken about in Greek mythology, or another city built upon it centuries later. The earliest account for this war comes from Homer, who lived around the 8th century BC, several centuries after the event took place, and doesn't appear to have been written down until even later, likely during the 6th century BC. Homer's Iliad is an ancient Greek epic poem set in the 10th year of the siege against Troy. A number of key events happen in the poem, including a duel between the king of Sparta and husband of Helen against Paris, with the winner supposed to receive Helen as a prize, ending the war. However, the gods intervene to break up the duel before it's finished, and the war continues. Contrary to popular belief, the Iliad does not end with the destruction of Troy, but with a temporary truce after which the fighting presumably continues. Another work attributed to Homer is the Odyssey, set after the destruction of the city, referencing how the Greeks took Troy using the famous Trojan horse, a wooden structure concealing warriors within it. The city, immortalized by Homer's poems, and allegedly discovered by Heinrich Schliemann, seems to be located on an archaeological site that shows that it was inhabited going back at least 5,000 years, not to mention other nearby sites, such as Göbekli Tepe, that date back twice as far. After one city was destroyed, a new city would be built on top of it, creating a human-made mound called a tell. According to researchers from the University of Amsterdam, there is not one single Troy. There are at least 10 lying in layers on top of each other. So while Schliemann's 17-year-old Greek wife, Sophia, looked very impressive, adorned in all that ancient gold and treasures he discovered, there still remains doubt if he dug down deep enough to reach the actual Troy spoken about in myth, and not another city built upon it at a later date. The same could be said about the famous funeral mask of Agamemnon that he discovered in 1876, with no real indication it actually belonged to the Mycenaean king Agamemnon, leader of the Greeks in Homer's Iliad, despite the fact that it was made of gold and was found at the site of Mycenae. That said, let's take a closer look at the mythology from another perspective. If you study the Iliad closely, you'll discover that the shields of the leaders of the Greek armies at the siege of Troy were painted with lions or serpents, while the Trojan defenders also had lions or eagles on their shields. The Iliad also describes a huge eagle as appearing over the contending armies at the siege of Troy. What do these symbols mean? According to Josephus, in his Antiquities of the Jews, the Spartan king Arios sent an embassy to the Jewish high priest acknowledging that the Jews and Spartans were racially akin, both having descended from Abraham. It's also interesting to note that the seal on the letter from Sparta showed an eagle holding a serpent, a symbol we see in other places, which I will get to in a future video. As for the Trojan lion, this is also a biblically referenced symbol we find in Genesis. So were some of the ancient Greeks and Trojans related to each other? I recently made a video about lion symbology, which I will leave a link to in the description. In the Greek legends, we find that Dardanus, son of Zeus and Electra, was the founder of Dardanus in Troad, named after himself. Troad was a region in Anatolia, and according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, Dardanus became the founder of the royal house of Troy, his original home being Arcadia, which was located in the Peloponnese. Peloponnese is the region of Greece where the Spartans were from. So where did Dardanus come from? I'll get to that shortly. According to the 9th century British historian and Welsh monk Nennius, who authored The History of the Britons, about the ancient history of the indigenous British folk, a group of people under the leadership of Brutus, from whom Britain took its name, invaded England some 1,100 years before the time of Jesus, or over 3,000 years ago, and set up a dynasty of British kings. The legends and histories of the ancient world trace Brutus and his people back to Italy, and through his ancestors, back to ancient Troy. Keep in mind, this was a time of major upheaval and earth changes in the area, which affected the entire Mediterranean. Many scholars attribute this time as coinciding with what is recorded in the Bible as the time of Exodus. Hecateus of Abdera, a 4th century BC Greek historian, states that, quote, "Now the Egyptians say that also after these events, a great number of colonies were spread from Egypt all over the inhabited world. They say also that those who set forth with Danaus, likewise from Egypt, settled what is practically the oldest city of Greece, Argos," end quote. Some scholars link Dardanus with Darda of the Bible, the son of Zara and grandson of Judah. The Athenians believed that they themselves were colonists from Sias in Egypt, according to Diodorus of Sicily, the ancient Greek historian and author of Bibliotheca Historica from around 60 BC. That said, according to the Egyptians, via Plato, the ancient Egyptian priests of Sias said that both Sias in Egypt and Athens of Greece were founded by the same patron goddess, Athena, or Neith, to the Egyptians. So it becomes interesting once we make the connection between Egypt, Greece, Italy, ancient Anatolia, or Troy, and Northern Europe, or Britain. In my last video, we talked about the Etruscans, the civilization that predated the Roman Empire in Italy, who did not call themselves Etruscan, which comes from Etruria or Tuscana, the Roman name of their homeland. Etruscans called themselves Rasena or Rasna, or later Rutuli, all of which come to mean red or the red ones. We know the Etruscans depicted themselves painted red, and even with blonde hair, used red ochre to color their skin red, much like another ancient Mediterranean civilization from the island of Crete, the Minoans, which is also not what they called themselves, as Minoan comes from Minotaur, which translated means bull of Minos. That said, the Minoans, like the Etruscans, also painted their white skin with red ochre, and like the Etruscans, worshipped the goddess and revered the serpent. The ancient Egyptian pharaohs also depicted themselves as red, applying red ochre to their skin and mummies, as depicted in their art, along with the serpent. Which brings us to the Phoenicians, a maritime civilization of the ancient Mediterranean, who are considered Canaanites, and were called Phoenicians by the Greek, from the Greek word phainos, meaning red. Also, in a recent video, I talked about the Vikings, Eric the Red, and I said that his name was likely due to his red beard, which may or may not have been his natural hair color, but I used some ambiguity because I didn't want to get into what I'm discussing now, which is a link between the Viking runes and the Phoenician alphabet, both of whom share similarities not only in ship design, but both adorn their vessels with serpents, as did the Etruscans, who incidentally were well-known pirates. And the word Viking itself means pirate. I also previously covered the Redskin Indians of the New World, who painted their white skin red and also used swastikas and serpent symbolism. So it seems that there was an ancient seafaring civilization from the Americas to the Mediterranean to Northern Europe and other places, but I'm running out of time, who revered the goddess in their religion, which today is called pagan, as well as snakes, or serpent symbology, which today is vilified as evil and are associated with the color red, which is also the color attributed to the tribe of Dan, whose unique symbol is, you guessed it, the snake. Of course, this story is much older than the Bible, as Plato said while alluding to the colors of Atlantis, and I quote from Critias, "The stone which was used in the work they quarried from underneath the center island and from underneath the zones, on the outer as well as the inner side. One kind was white, another black, and a third red." It's interesting that the flag of Egypt consists of these same three Atlantean colors of red, white, and black, with an eagle which in pagan times represented Zeus, the planet Jupiter, that has a 12-year orbit around the sun, which is why the zodiac on our modern calendar is based on 12, which was extended to 12 by the ancient Romans when Emperor Augustus added July for Julius Caesar and August, named after himself, the ancient Roman eagle being their emblem, the same emblem as nationalist Germany that rejected the out-of-Africa theory in favor for research into origins from Atlantis, and whose flag, which I'm not permitted to show here, used the same swastika as found in Troy or Greece and other places, and whose flag also used black, white, and red. The Phrygians were an ancient Indo-European or Aryan people who during classical antiquity lived in western Anatolia or the Balkans, and more specifically today's Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia, eastern Germany, Albania, and western Ukraine. Herodotus states that according to the Macedonians, they migrated into Anatolia probably between 1200 BC and 800 BC, due to the Bronze Age collapse, particularly the fall of the Hittite Empire. The state of Phrygia rose in the 8th century BC in modern Turkey, passed successively into the Persian Empire of Cyrus the Great, then the Empire of Alexander and his successors, and eventually became part of the Roman Empire. Herodotus also states that it was acknowledged by the Egyptians that the Phrygians were a nation older than the Egyptians. Josephus claimed that the Phrygians were founded by the biblical figure Togarmah, grandson of Japheth, from who the ancient Aryans are said to be descended from. The Phrygian language is now extinct, but their cultural influence and identity can be recognized in ancient art. In classical Greek iconography, Paris, the son of King Priam of Troy, is represented as non-Greek by his Phrygian cap. And according to the Iliad, the Phrygians were Trojan allies during the Trojan War. It was worn also by Mithras, the Indo-Iranian or Aryan deity, which gave rise to a mystery cult in the Roman world whose cap has a soft conical shape. The Amazons, the tribe of women warriors of mythology, are also associated with the Phrygian cap, which incidentally is where the Amazigh, the Caucasian tribes of northern Africa around Mount Atlas, get their name. They're more commonly referred to as Berbers, but that's a derogatory term which comes from barbarians, who also were associated with the cap. The Scythians, another Aryan tribe, were also depicted wearing the Phrygian headgear, as well as the Thracians, most notably Bendis, the Thracian goddess of the moon, and the hunt. It survived into modern imagery as the Liberty Cap of the American and French revolutionaries, which came to signify freedom and the pursuit of liberty. But the Phrygian caps did not originally function as Liberty Caps. The original Cap of Liberty was the Roman pallius, the felt cap of emancipated slaves of ancient Rome. I'll go into this in more detail in an upcoming video on Spartacus, a Thracian gladiator that escaped slavery and led an uprising against the Roman Republic. In the 4th century BC, the early Hellenistic period, the Phrygian cap was associated with Attis, of Greek mythology, whose priests were eunuchs. This cult started with the deity Agdistis, who had both male and female attributes. As the story goes, the Olympian gods cut off the male organ and cast it away, but I'll leave this myth to a future video as well. Conical hats have also been attributed to witchcraft and forms of divination, with some very ancient ones made of gold thought to contain astronomical and calendrical symbols used in ancient rituals and prophecy. Early Christian art depicts the three wise men, the Magi, where we get the term magician, as wearing the Phrygian cap, who were experts in the art of astrology and magic. The cap also appears in depictions of the legendary King Midas, who had the magic Midas touch, turning anything he touched into gold. This brings us to an interesting discovery made recently of a large, inscribed stone found by a Turkish farmer while dredging an irrigation canal that has led to the uncovering of an ancient city belonging to a king rumored to have defeated King Midas, the mythical Greek ruler. The stone was extracted using the farmer's tractor and transported to a Turkish museum for cleaning, photographing, and translation. Scholars from the Oriental Institute translated the hieroglyphic markings written in Luwian, one of the oldest branches of Indo-European languages native to the Turkish region, and read by alternating between right to left and left to right. Markings indicated that the messages came from a king named Hartapu towards the end of the 8th century BC, the same time as Midas's mythical rule, and boasted of defeating the golden-handed king of Phrygia. So it's possible that Midas is based on a real 8th century king. King Hartapu likely ruled the area surrounding the ancient city that would have covered an expanse of around 300 acres at its peak, making it one of the largest cities of the Bronze and Iron Age in Turkey. Today, a large earthen mound covers what archaeologists believe was a large empire 3,000 years ago. The lead archaeologist said, quote, "Inside this mound are going to be palaces, monuments, and houses. This is a marvelous, incredibly lucky find. Excavations are planned for this summer." In another recent video, I discussed the esoteric meaning of the double-headed eagle, and while I could have gone much deeper into its occult significance, I should have also emphasized that its earliest appearance is also in Anatolia, or modern Turkey, in what was part of the Hittite Empire, one of the earliest, if not the earliest, Aryan offshoot from the original Proto-Indo-Europeans. Another local attraction, which may technically be regarded as in Armenia, is Mount Ararat, the biblical mountain that Noah allegedly settled on after the Great Deluge, part of the Caucasus Mountains, where we get the term Caucasian from, and where many occult authors, secret societies, and pre-World War II archaeologists claim some of the survivors from Atlantis settled after the demise of their legendary homeland. The Canary Islands are located just off the coast of Africa, in the Atlantic, about 62 miles west of Morocco, in a region known as Macronesia. The largest of the 8 main islands is called Tenerife, with about a half a dozen other smaller islands that make up the archipelago. In ancient times, the island chain was often referred to as the Fortunate Islands, and historically have been considered a bridge in the Atlantic Ocean between the four continents, Africa, North America, South America, and Europe. The Canaries, as they're informally called, have a population of just over 2 million inhabitants, with almost half living on Tenerife, which sees about 5 million tourists a year, one of the most important tourist destinations in Spain, of which it's technically a part of since 1496, when the island was officially conquered. The aboriginal inhabitants were called Guanches, which literally means person of Tenerife, and they were fierce fighters, handing the Spanish forces and their European allies a crushing defeat in their first major battle in 1494. That said, many of the natives died from new European infectious diseases, such as the flu and probably smallpox, to which they lacked resistance and immunity, with many of the surviving women intermarrying with the colonists as they were regarded as extremely beautiful, attractive, and desirable. Genetically speaking, the native aboriginal population were most similar to the native Berbers of North Africa, who called themselves Amazigh, confirmed by data from genome-wide testing in 2017. They were tall, fair-skinned, with much of the population being blonde or redheaded, which can be attested to not only through DNA, but by the mummies they left by their ruling class. Population demographics change, and the ethnic makeup you see somewhere today, such as in North Africa, for example, is different than it was in the past, especially over centuries or millennia. The native population of North Africa, which should probably be named South Mediterranean instead, consists of people who, prior to Islamification, slave trades, and migrations, were genetically closest to certain Europeans, such as the ancient Basque, who lived between Spain and France, who also shared genetic affinities to the fair-skinned mummies of Tenerife. This week, it was reported that, in addition to the mummies that were found on the island, a collective burial has been discovered by drone. We are in a burial cave in a cemetery of the ancient Canary Islands. It is a collective burial. They regularly use these ancient caves to bury their dead. We're talking about a human collective, a burial that represents the entire community. We have men and we have women of different ages represented, including many children. In addition to the skeletal remains that we are finding, we also find the remains of the wraps with which they are buried with. In this location, we have deposits, a minimum number of 65 individuals. The site is unique, special, as it teaches us about the past, reminds us about our identity and who we are. The human remains on the Canary Islands are in exceptional condition and, most importantly, shows human collaboration. It is imperative that we continue to invite people who want to participate and provide archaeological assistance, paying special attention to conservation, and so it is important for people to participate, collaborate, and feel that it is all about our responsibility to conserve our heritage, to protect it, in addition to learning from it. The Guanches were the last known Caucasian-type people still living in the Stone Age when they were conquered by the Spanish, as the island had no metal, and the Guanches had no boats. In fact, they seemed to have a distinct fear of the water, and lived on Tenerife only, not even traveling to other islands in the archipelago. That said, DNA sequencing of Cro-Magnon types conclude that they were genetically identical to certain modern European demographics. Would you like to guess which ones? The museum on Tenerife boasts the largest collection of Cro-Magnon skulls anywhere in the world, and the Guanches, the original natives of the Canary Islands, were direct descendants of Cro-Magnon, which in my book, Species with Amnesia, I explain is the origin of Rh negative blood type, which incidentally is not a mutation. I'll include a link in the description to a video I did on this subject, which covers it in a bit more detail. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon, as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your comments. So please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.